KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The filmmaker Ian Chaney had heard the term climate change so many times, in some ways it started to lose its impact. He wanted to make a film about climate change, but he needed to find a new perspective, a new way of explaining the stakes of a warming planet. So he thought of a different planet. He thought of using Mars as a way of illustrating what is happening here. Chaney's documentary is a thought experiment built around this question. What would it take to make Mars habitable? What would we have to change about the place in order for us to live there? The film is called Blue Space, and next week we're screening it as part of our documentary series. Today, Ian Chaney is joining us to talk about the film and what reshaping Mars can teach us about making Earth more habitable. Join us after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you come to our documentary screening of Ian Chaney's film next week, you'll see immediately how he's trying to get you to change your perspective about the environment. You'll see these beautiful, surreal images of rock and ice and water, and you'll wonder which are from Earth and which are from Mars. The film is about the effects of climate change, how human development is causing the rise of sea levels and altering natural systems and polluting waterways. But you've heard that story before. Chaney's twist is to start with Mars, with the planet Mars. He plays with this science fiction concept called terraforming. It's the idea of transforming another planet to make it so humans can live there. And there are plenty of writers who have imagined this. Chaney uses it as a thought experiment, as a way of getting people to think in new ways about the Earth's environment. The film is called Blue Space. We're going to be screening it next week, as I said. We'll give you more details about that. Today, Ian Chaney talks about it. And so we began our conversation with this idea that got him thinking about Earth and Mars.
I began thinking about this film when I was living in New York City, in Brooklyn, New York. I was living in a little neighborhood called Red Hook, which is industrial neighborhood right on the water, and kind of have a front row seat for all things waterfront down in Red Hook. And as these big storms started to hit, and my office was near there, right next to a famously polluted canal called the Gowanus Canal.
Yeah.
And so as these storms, Irene, Sandy, hit, and you know, the waters were rising, and so many New Yorkers, I think, were reawakened to the fact that New York was a city on the water. I realized that I'd become rather numb to the fact that we were a city on the water, that climate change was happening, and in fact, numb to conversations about climate change and our relationship to the environment more broadly. Which is to say, I think there was something in me that needed to be refreshed, and I needed a new perspective. So I was kind of looking for a way to make a film about where I was in the city, using new perspectives. And also around this time, as the city was grappling, as many coastal cities are now grappling with their relationship to the water and what it's going to mean in an era of climate change, there were a lot of conversations about engineering, about how humans should, you know, how should we defend ourselves against the water, or build dams, or, you know, what should be the relationship of humans to the to the waterfront. And it was, in some weird way, it reminded me of these science fiction stories from my childhood, and specifically about terraforming, this idea of transforming an alien planet into a Earth-like environment. So I decided to try and make a film in which I wove these stories together, used the idea of terraforming Mars as a kind of thought experiment for thinking in new ways about our environments here on Earth, and particularly about our coastal cities.
sorry, let's explain, first of all, what terraformation is. And I want to play a clip because I think it explains, it gives us sort of the basics of what it is, and we can talk about it. But this also really gets at what you're trying to do with the film. This is Robert Crossley. He's a writer who wrote a book called Imagining Mars, and he's featured in your film. Here's a moment from the film, Blue Space.
Terraformation is simply the process of altering an environment to make it Earth-like. It provides the opportunity for a thought experiment. What can imagining the reshaping of Mars teach us about ourselves? It gives us a chance to think freshly about our relationship to a world.
How have you thought about the kind of film you wanted to make? This is, as you get a sense in just that clip, there's a more kind of poetic sensibility, certainly visually, certainly the way the narrative plays out. I read one review of the film that said it requires more from viewers. How did you think about the kind of style you wanted for the film?
Stylistically, that's right. It was a big departure from the style of my previous films. The pacing is very different. There's no narration in a conventional sense or text on screen kind of telling you where you are or what to think or how it all fits together. So it's a... I think it's a... It does ask a bit more of the viewer, hopefully inviting viewers in to connect the constellation of ideas in the film in their own ways. Mm. And I think also the... It was partly that, this desire to make a film that that didn't so much answer questions or push forward a particular thesis so much as invite people into asking the types of questions that I found myself asking as I was wandering the banks of the Gowanus Canal or walking along the waterfront. I think I also wanted to try and, in a way, make a film that felt a little alien and felt a little perspective altering, put people in a slightly different headspace. And much of that, I think we tried to achieve with the sound design. I'd always admittedly, somewhat embarrassingly now, thought of the sound design as a kind of an afterthought, as a way of cleaning up the film before it's ready to show in theaters or go on TV. Whereas with this film, I think we tried to think about it from the inception. How can the soundscapes help to achieve that sense of disorientation or altering of perspective?
Well, speaking of a perspective shift, you were talking earlier about how you wanted this, you know, you don't want this to be necessarily seen as a quote-unquote message film, that you want it to be more of a, as you said, kind of a perspective shift. Here's that idea reflected again by Robert Crossley, the writer in the film. Let me play this moment, and I want to ask you about this.
J.R.R. Tolkien used to always say that the greatest enemy to the imagination is familiarity, and that the more familiar we are with our world and its problems, the less we see. But if you can step back and have a different vantage point, then suddenly you begin to see things as if they were new again.
You mentioned the sound, which is really kind of freakish and alien, as you said. But then I wanted you to say something about the images. And the images of basically a lot of images, beautiful natural images, like beautiful sort of austere images of lichen and ice, but also of just crap and junk in pollution. And those images are also beautiful in their way, which is kind of interesting. And I wonder if you thought about it in those terms.
I did. And I appreciate your pointing that out, because my own eyes for my landscape, for my neighborhoods, changed as I went about making this film. I began to appreciate my neighborhood in very different ways than I had before. the Gowanus Canal, as perverse as this sounds, is beautiful on many days with its weird shifting kaleidoscope of colors from all the oil slicks and pollution bubbling up and trickling down. And there was something about that tragic beauty of how we've arguably, or perhaps inarguably, mishandled landscapes here on Earth that I wanted to convey, so that it wasn't just a story of, oh, we humans, what we do is we take pristine natural environments and we muck them up. That's all we're capable of. I think the relationship is in fact much more complicated than that.
Yeah.
And I think we need to, you know, we need to acknowledge that moving forward as engineers and designers and shapers of landscapes, is that we are capable of all sorts of good and all sorts of bad. And, you know, ignoring that or oversimplifying that tends to be when we start to get into trouble.
Yeah. And we'll come back to this, but also just how pervasive, how adamant life is, like how ecosystems develop and persist and even thrive in all this gunk, which is sort
right.
of interesting.
Right. That's right. That's an even better point. I mean, the Gowanus Canal is a great place to start to think about what we mean by toxic or polluted, because we mean toxic to humans. You know, humans could not thrive in the Gowanus Canal. And in many ways, as we do what we do on the planet Earth, we're rendering many landscapes increasingly inhospitable. But that doesn't mean that they're inhospitable to all life. I mean, the Gowanus Canal is teeming with microorganisms and bacteria. You know, if you kind of extend that idea to a planet like Mars, you in a way have to run it in reverse. We might peer at Mars and think, oh, this is a lifeless, barren, alien place. It should be transformed into something that could be fit for humans. But in fact, it might be that there is life hiding out there somewhere. We haven't found it yet.
Right.
But that we need to kind of change the way we think about life and nature.
Let me play a moment, speaking of that point, from Steve Schmidt. He's a microbiologist from the University of Colorado. He's in the film, and he's explaining just that idea that there in the gunk in that canal is this kind of ecosystem that's developed in this muck.
If you took a sample of the Gowanus Canal, there's been microbes adapting and evolving in that environment, quite a variety of different kinds of microbes there. And we actually see evolution happening where we think new species are being formed in toxic waste sites where they're adapting to be able to actually eat some of those toxic waste or to be resistant to them, so that what we think of as extreme to other forms of life isn't extreme.
I was interested in that idea of extreme. Like, what are you getting at there? That life is, I don't know. I just think it's so interesting. There's a section in the film where there's this researcher who is testing to see whether these really sort of hardy microbes on Earth could, in theory, exist, live on Mars. And it turns out, in theory anyway, they could.
Yeah, as we push further and further out into the solar system, looking for life, I think scientists and engineers, I think all, you know, we're all learning to, and filmmakers, we're learning that we need to look for life with new eyes, and look for it in places that our formerly, you know, human-centric eyes might not have found it. And extremophiles are a really great example of this, because where there's even traces of water on the planet Earth, we've almost always found some life, even in environments that are extremely hostile to humans. And I think if we, expand this idea and relate it to this question of terraforming, if terraforming is this idea of taking a lifeless world and making it Earth-like, I think the story of extremophiles reminds us that Earth is not a simple place. Mm-hmm. What do we mean by making an Earth? Do we really mean making an Earth that's nice for humans to live? Or do we mean making a place that's teeming with some kind of life? People often kind of quip that long after humans have, blown ourselves up or rendered ourselves useless on the planet, that microbes will continue to flourish on the planet Earth. And I think that that perspective is really important when we start thinking about colonizing other worlds and transforming them. Is what do we mean by this? What are we trying to make? And you can also flip that back and say, well, what exactly are we trying to make here on Earth? Are we making the Earth less Earth-like as we change the climate, as we pollute canals? Or are we just making it, in fact, less hospitable for humans?
It's Ian Chaney. He is the director of the new documentary film Blue Space, which you can see next Wednesday night at 7. We're going to be screening it at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City. All of this is part of our Through the Lens film series, our partnership with Utah Film Center. Ian is going to be there for a Q&A after the film, though you should take note, seating is limited, so you'll need to get there early. You can get all of the details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our series on documentary films with a really unique one this time. It's from the director Ian Chaney, and it's this poetic and provocative film about how you make the planet Mars suitable for humans to live. We're going to be screening this film. It's called Blue Space next week. Today in the program, Ian Chaney is with us to talk about it. The film really is this thought experiment about climate change. How would reshaping Mars help us think differently about our relationship with this planet? I want to back up and talk about Mars in sort of the broad sense. What does Mars represent? I mean, you've talked about how it sort of exists in our imagination. So I guess in that sense, it's a good place to work out our ideas about how we could manipulate or engineer our own world. But talk about the significance of Mars.
Sure. I mean, probably for many of us, Mars doesn't signify much of anything at all. It may not be something we're thinking of day in and day out. But Mars has found its way into much of our literature, much of our culture, much of our history, and increasingly a lot of our science. We could talk about Mars for days, but I guess I'll just highlight a few things. One of them is that Mars has, in a way, always served as a kind of reference point for people trying to think differently about the planet Earth. Ever since we've been peering at Mars, we've been fascinated with the notion that there might be something living there. It's an Earth-like rocky planet. It's smaller than Earth. It's more distant from the sun. But it's captivated our imagination that there might be something alive there, and there might be water there. And as such, it gives us this kind of blank slate in literature for playing out stories, playing out political arguments that might be too close to home if we played them out here on Earth. So in science fiction, there's just a really rich tradition of stories unfolding on the planet Mars that are meant to serve as mirrors for mm-hmm. us to look at what we're doing here on Earth. And that was one reason I became really interested in using Mars for thinking about climate and thinking about the way we engineer environments is because of that tradition. And that tradition was perhaps maybe best articulated in Bob Crossley's book, Imagining Mars, but also in Kim Stanley Robinson's amazing science fiction trilogy called the Mars Trilogy, Red Mars, mm-hmm. Blue Mars, Green Mars.
We'll come back to him, by the way, because he's a really great part of the story. Here's the thing I didn't realize, and this is something that Crossley talks about in the film. You mentioned the idea, there's this Italian astronomer, Giovanni Schiaparelli, who was fascinated by Mars. This was in the 19th century, and he has this telescope, and he thought he saw these canals. And then there was this Percival Lowell, who was influenced by Schiaparelli. You tell the story in the film, and Lowell is also thinking he sees canals and wants to figure out the mystery of Mars, and he has this big telescope too. But here's the thing I didn't realize, that this idea about canals on Mars had an influence in some way, at least this is what Crossley talks about, on humans and how we developed these big canal projects like the Erie Canal and like the way we were thinking about the Suez and the Panama Canal. Let me play this another moment from the film. This is Robert Crossley again from Blue Space.
The whole subject of Mars and water had been in play at least since the 18th century, when 18th century astronomers concluded that there was no other planet in the solar system that was more Earth-like than Mars. Lowell's canals gave a new lease on that desire to see Mars as a watery, Earth-like world. People wouldn't let it go.
So that's something I hadn't realized, that it had this influence on some of our water projects on Earth.
Yeah, I wish we had. I'd have to put that question to Bob to see whether he thought that the fact that folks like Schiaparelli and Lowell thought they were seeing canals on Mars kind of looped back to how we saw canals here on Earth. I do think that one of the remarkable things that Bob was pointing out was that perhaps one of the reasons we thought we saw canals on Mars is because on Earth at that time, canals were seen as as the kind of epitome of human engineering, of advanced civilizations. Mm-hmm. And for Lowell in particular, I mean, not to get too into the weeds on Lowell and Mars, but for him in particular, he thought the Martians were an incredibly advanced civilization, and it was tied into this utopian vision he had of Mars, that the Martians had kind of overcome their, you know, petty national tribal boundaries, and they'd banded together as a planet to engineer canals that brought water down from the polar caps to the parched, you know, deserts of Mars. So he played out this whole story, which I think was probably related to what he hoped would happen on Earth as people descended into a world war and so forth. And in the late 19th, early 20th century was when Lowell was writing and making these observations. So there's a fascinating way in which canals came to represent, you know, what humans could do. Mm-hmm. And for me, there was the profound irony of walking the banks of the Gowanus Canal, which itself was dug around the time that Lowell and Schiaparelli were seeing these canals on Mars.
Wow.
Which had become, you know, not a symbol of what humans were capable of in a positive sense, but of course a symbol of of devastation, of pollution, of taking a formerly productive marsh with oysters and birds and turning it into something that you, you know, you didn't want to dip a finger into.
Right. It's been about, I think, almost 10 years now since your film King Corn. You and this friend, Curtis Ellis, you moved from Boston to Iowa to grow corn, basically, and you sort of explore the effects of agribusiness on the family farm. That's one thing you sort of get at there. And I'm wondering, it seems like this film, while it's completely different stylistically, is kind of a continuation on your theme of how, it seems anyway, how human societies kind of want to manipulate natural processes. Is that, did I get that right?
It's long been fascinating to me, and it because it's something that I find in myself is this conflicted relationship between my desire to, you know, participate in the natural world and grow a farm or cut down a tree, or, you know, I remember playing in the stream behind my parents' house as a kid, and we were always, you know, moving stones around to build dams. And in other words, the kind of innate engineer in all of us as humans, and the conflict between that and, you know, our instinct to preserve and protect the non-human natural world, and our recognition that we may be engineers, but we don't entirely know what we're doing yet, and we tend to muck things up. So in King Corn, that's right, we trace the story of our great-grandfathers. Kurt and I had grown up on opposite coasts, but incredibly we discovered we had great-grandfathers from the same county in Iowa who had been very much a part of that generation that plowed the prairie and transformed it into the monocultural landscape that it is today. So I think that film was, on a personal level for me and Kurt, was a matter of acknowledging that our families were a part of this environmental change, environmental degradation that has gone on since we've plowed the prairie and let so much topsoil run down to the sea. So that aspect of it in particular is something I'm very interested in, is how do we acknowledge what we're capable of as human beings as we go forward with ever new projects to shape the environment, whether it's geoengineering in the era of climate change, or probably in the not too distant future, beginning the terraforming of Mars.
Yeah. In fact, here's the writer Kim Stanley Robinson making that point in the film.
This notion of terraforming is a science fiction idea, and yet it's based on what we've done to the Earth. Infrastructure building and canal building and harbor building and manipulation of the seacoasts everywhere. Humanity taking a planet and gardening it or shaping it to serve their own purposes. We are really the major force of change on the surface of the planet, human beings are. So we're not in control, but we are a major disturber. As we gain more and more power, we have more and more power to mess things up or to make them sustainable.
I guess that's the choice, right? Or at least those are the options. Like, we can completely screw this up, or we can figure it out. That does seem like kind of another theme in the film.
That's right. I think Kim Stanley Robinson in particular is really adroit at pointing out this complicated relationship humans have to the natural world. We love to engineer things. We love to think about reshaping our world. I mean, that's how we came to be a civilization, was by developing agriculture and cities and so forth. So it's very much how we define ourselves and distinguish ourselves from other living beings on the planet. And yet we also, especially in this era, and you know, really in the last 50 years, it's come into focus. We realize now how much destructive power we have over the natural world. And with it, this idea of sustainability has come to the fore. How can we engineer our environments in such a way that they're that we don't undercut the underpinnings of our civilization, which is the natural world? So for me, though, you know, those questions are so important that when I felt like I was losing energy for thinking about them and talking about them, you know, I'd heard the phrase climate change one too many times, or resilience along the seacoast. I thought, how do I personally refresh myself and refresh my perspective? And in that sense, the film is a very selfish endeavor. But I also think it's something that I've heard from environmentalists, from anyone working to shift the status quo, is that you know, that burnout can set in, that exhaustion can set in. So I've always been very interested — this is kind of a tangent — but I've always been very interested as a filmmaker in finding ways to manage my own burnout. And and in some ways that probably gets reflected in the styles of the films.
Well, it's great because it works and you're doing something unique and I have to say really, really original. And which is hard to express on the radio, I have to say, because we're hearing this great sort of ethereal music, but people who come to the screening next week will be able to see the images that sort of go along with it. I want to ask you about Chris McKay, an astrobiologist with NASA, in fact, that you interview. He's great, and he sort of goes with you on this thought experiment of what you would have to do to get Mars ready to be, you know, colonized by humans, or at least to get it ready for life. Would you talk about this moment in the film where he sort of explains that if we're going to make life possible again, or on Mars, or on Mars, you'd have to warm it up, and there's this kind of weird irony in that. As he says, we're pretty good at figuring that out. We know how to warm up planets. We're doing it on this one. Talk about this moment in the film, if you would.
Sure, it is so crazy that the way to make Mars habitable for human beings is to accelerate its greenhouse effect.
Right.
It's to you know, introduce climate change, precisely the thing that we're so worried is going to render Earth less habitable for millions and millions of human beings who are either because of desertification or rising sea level. So climate change here on Earth is this existential threat. On Mars, it's the way to make it livable for human being, because Mars is cold. It's a red planet, so I think there's something instinctive in us humans that we think it's hot, but it's further out than the planet Earth from the sun. It's very cold, and it likely once had more of an atmosphere than it does, but now whatever atmosphere it has is very thin, so it doesn't trap much heat. So to warm up Mars, you introduce greenhouse gases, fluorocarbons. You know, you could make factories that introduce greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and warm it up. And within 100 years, Chris McKay suggests, we could warm it up enough that Earth life forms, not humans, but, extremophiles, essentially, could live and flourish on the planet Mars. And then on a longer time frame, it could be warmed up for human habitation. But that fact alone, that the way to make Mars habitable was to warm it up, blew my mind in all sorts of different ways. And almost kind of took over the whole film.
You raised this big question in the film, and maybe we could get to because Chris McKay says, and thinking of, talking about this being a thought experiment, there's this big question that Chris McKay works through, and that is, okay, so in theory, we could warm up, you know, Mars, or in theory, we could introduce life back onto Mars or onto Mars. But should we? It seems like a really big question. And Chris McKay, again, this astrobiologist from NASA, says in his view that we probably should. In fact, let me play this a moment where he kind of makes his case.
It is possible to take the view that we shouldn't introduce life to other worlds, that Mars is Mars and we should leave it that way. My view is if there's a source of value in the natural world, life is it. And we humans have a very special opportunity in the sense that we can help propagate life. And if Mars has life, then we should encourage that life. If Mars doesn't have life, then we should share with it life from Earth.
What do you think about that? I feel conflicted about that. Like, really? Should we share life? Or should we just figure out what we're doing here? What do you think?
Right. It's such a layered comment, or there's so much, I think, for the viewer to think about when Chris McKay suggests that we have a special, power, responsibility to help propagate life, because we're all armed with this knowledge of what we've been doing to the planet Earth. So this idea that we're the ideal, and I know that Chris McKay understands this conflicted relationship too, so I don't want to oversimplify his perspective. But this idea that we're the vanguards of life in some pure sense, and therefore, without a second thought, we should proceed with the terraforming of Mars, is probably a little crazy to most people who understand that we're not yet perfect engineers of our own planet. So the ethics of terraforming Mars are complicated. And I think for example, for someone living in the American Southwest, the idea that rocks matter and have a kind of intrinsic value and beauty that is valuable to humans, and you wouldn't plow over Arches National Park or destroy the hoodoos of Bryce Canyon or fill in the Grand Canyon, even though what we value about those places isn't necessarily what is alive there. That kind of land ethic is really interesting if you apply it to Mars, because if Mars has no life and it is just rocks, what kind of value will be accorded to it? You know, do we decide that, oh, it is just a blank slate? Who cares? It's just a bunch of rubble. We can transform it into an Earth-like place. I think it's probably inarguable that life is amazing, and therefore almost, it might almost be impossible to not terraform Mars. But I think, and this is something that Kim Stanley Robinson takes up in his trilogy, is he kind of imagines that there might well be in some future terraforming of Mars a community of people who say, no, Mars should be preserved for what it was and what it's always been. Kind of the innate preservationist in us might come out. But I think that's a really interesting question, and we actually have an opportunity to have a conversation, as crazy as that sounds, because the terraforming of Mars still seems like it's kind of far away. But we're in this place where we're now understanding the technologies and the engineering that might be involved in terraforming Mars. We know we can change a planet on a planetary scale. We know we can warm up a planet because we've proved that here. So we're in this position where we have the opportunity to ask those ethical questions, those moral questions about landscapes that, of course, in the past we haven't always been careful about. Antarctica is a really interesting example of that, and how countries came together to, kind of agree to not cover it with hotels or dig it all up immediately. And the question is, what's going to happen when we start moving to Mars?
It's the filmmaker Ian Chaney. We're talking about his documentary Blue Space, which we're going to be screening next Wednesday night at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake City at 7 o'clock. This is our partnership with the Utah Film Center. You can get details on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the film director Ian Chaney. We're talking about his new film, Blue Space, which we're going to be screening next Wednesday night. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. Kim Stanley Robinson is a really important voice, of course, in the film. And he says to you in the film, you know, his novels about Mars are just metaphors for life on Earth. And he talks about how there's no contrast, he says, between space and environmentalism. They're not opposed to each other. In fact, he says they're these matched interests, which I don't think would have occurred to a lot of people. Like, they don't see a connection there. But for him, the connection makes a lot of sense. Talk about his role, his thinking.
Sure. When Stan said, he goes by Stan, his full name's Kim Stanley Robinson, but when he made that comment about space and environmentalism for him being a fluid, connected pair, I was so relieved, because it's a tension I've felt my whole life. I grew up, I went to astronomy camp and built my own telescope and was fascinated with astronomy and stargazing in my parents' field in Maine when I was a kid. I think, although I would never have articulated it this way at the time, I think for me, the idea that the stars were part of nature kind of got baked in. And yet, as I fell into environmentalism in college and became active in food and agriculture issues and sustainability and so forth, I had a really hard time finding other people who felt the same way. And in fact, would sometimes run into folks who suggested that, you know, peering up at the stars or exploring outer space really ran counter to environmental principles here on Earth, that this was a waste of time and money, and we have when we have so much to pay attention to down here on the Earth. And of course, that's true, and we always have to decide where to spend our resources. But anyway, this idea that that actually looking up and looking out and looking at other planets in particular can be not only not a waste of time, but can also be instructive, can also be helpful for reimagining what we're doing here on Earth, for seeing with new eyes what we're doing here on Earth. For me, that was something that Kim Stanley Robinson articulated so well, and even exemplified through his books. And there's many, many examples. I mean, even our understanding of climate change and the greenhouse effect was very much informed and inspired by observations of the planet Venus, which has a kind of runaway greenhouse effect, where the atmosphere is so thick and so hot that, you know, you try to land something on that planet and it melts in a matter of minutes. So the power of the stars and the power of planets to actually help us see our relationship to nature here on Earth is something that I think we could only, I'm personally only beginning to explore and understand.
Yeah, yeah.
And because there is no difference between the laws of the universe as they play out on Mars and the laws of the universe here on Earth. I mean, they're the same laws of physics and chemistry. These are very different places, and what happens, what unfolds on these planets is, of course, very different and fascinating. But but the laws are consistent.
But what's interesting too, though, is how Kim Stanley Robinson then sort of grounds the argument. You know, he's saying, yes, it's important to us for us to make the connections between environmentalism and space. Look up is important. But then he says, but then you've got to look back down. And in fact, let me play this moment, because he says his writing about Mars has made him, in fact, appreciate the Earth more. Here's a moment from the film.
Paradoxically, writing science fiction has made me more appreciative of just being a local gardener and makes me just appreciate being outdoors more. I've tried to spend as much of my life outdoors as I can, including moving my writing life out there, but also all of my spare time, because staying indoors when you don't have to is like staying in a spaceship when you've actually got a planet. I spent a week at the South Pole. It was by far the least interesting of my weeks in Antarctica because I was really stuck indoors. And it's like being stuck in a Motel 6 or something, a high-tech Motel 6 for a week. And after that, you're thinking, I need to get out of here. Well, going to Mars would be like that, like a lifetime sentence. You're condemning yourself to a prison, and you're locked in order to keep you alive. The way that we are become accustomed to spending the vast majority of our time indoors is a mistake, I think. We're not biologically made for that. All my science fiction about people off in space and in the solar system has made me more aware of how unusual Earth is and how lucky we are to be on it, how much I am a creature of Earth.
I'm really glad he said this. I'm glad you include this part in the film because it's such a kind of a wise reminder. I mean, we meet a lot of people who long to be on Mars, you know, and he's just sort of reminding us of this kind of like, all right, but this is a nice place too, and we really need to sort of, you know, care for the place, I guess.
Right. Right. I asked Dan if he wanted to go to Mars, and he said, I'd love to go, but I definitely want to come back.
Right.
You know, it'd be great to go there for a month and poke around and see what that's like. But, you know, as many astronauts will tell you, you know, they long for Earth. And that time up in a small capsule in space really makes you appreciate what we obviously take for granted every day. I mean, mm-hmm. walk out and at least in most places can breathe the air and in many places can drink the water. And yet, I mean, precisely that point, the air and the water, so many of our environments on the planet Earth, we are clogging the air or we are poisoning the water, so we're making it less livable. So that perspective of another world, which is so toxic, where you would have to live in a capsule, where you would have to, you know, filter your water every day and mm-hmm. Think so carefully about the fundamentals of what it takes to stay alive, makes it even more absurd what we're doing to environments here on Earth. I mean, on a very basic level, this film, which partly explores our quest to find liquid water in outer space, because that could then be a toehold for life and then be a toehold for human life, it was a reminder of how careless we are about water here on planet Earth. The Gowanus Canal being a great example of that, but there are countless examples of how we take for granted that which really sustains us, and it's hard to kind of keep up our energy for remembering that and for fighting for that, and sometimes it It may take, in fact, the perspective of another planet to remind us of where we are. And that's something Chris McKay points out in the film, is as an astrobiologist who thinks so much about other worlds, peering up at the solar system, he also, like Kim Stanley Robinson said, it made him really appreciate what we have here on Earth. I mean, even the simple act of taking a shower can feel like a revelation after you've realized how fraught that would be on another world. I've never personally spent time in a space capsule, but as a resident of the 21st century, spending a lot of my time indoors peering at computers, I find it every day more and more absurd that I'm often making films encouraging people to go outdoors or connect to the natural world while I stay inside in my space capsule staring at computers.
The filmmaker Ian Chaney. His new documentary is called Blue Space. We're going to be screening the film next Wednesday night. We get started at 7 o'clock. This is the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in downtown Salt Lake. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Ian Chaney is going to join us for a Q&A after the film. You can get details about all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.